Okay, we're going to be looking at the life of Joseph. Yes, well done. You didn't see that one coming, did you? We're just going to read a few verses from Genesis chapter 41 and verses 33 through to 40. This is Joseph speaking after he'd been called out of prison, summoned out of his lowly position, sort of brought before Pharaoh. Pharaoh's had the dream, and then Joseph has interpreted this dream, or the two dreams, with the cows and the wheat. And Joseph speaking says this: "And now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food of these good years that are coming and store them up, the grain, under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in cities for food. This food should be held in reserve for the country to be used during the 7 years of famine that will come upon Egypt, so that the country may not be ruined by the famine." The plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, "Can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you, and you shall be in charge of my palace and all my people. They are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." So here's Joseph. He's interpreted the dream, which was the request of Pharaoh, but it's sort of interpretation plus. He's actually said to him, look, the smart thing to do here is to store it up during the good years. And the idea being that there's going to be so much that just taking a fifth of it will last for a year under normal conditions. So you can see this is going to be a real bumper crop that's coming. Tells him how to organise it. And not only is Pharaoh sort of impressed with the interpretation, but is impressed with the plan and thinks, that's a smart move. Who am I going to get to look after it? And then he thought, well, who's come up with the idea? Now, we're not told whether Joseph sort of came up with this idea simply because during his time sort of in the prisons, looking after households, etc., is gathered the acumen, the wisdom to sort it out, or whether God dropped it into his head that this was a good thing to do. I guess to sort of come up with the idea that a fifth is going to cover a full year, a fifth of the harvest is going to come a full year, well, I don't know, possibly God dropped it into his mind to sort of work with those proportions. The plan seemed like a good plan. The idea, the wisdom, seemed like such a good idea that he thought, well, the guy who's telling me is the guy to sort this out. Because if he's smart enough to come up with a plan, he's smart enough to actually carry it through. Just think of this from Joseph's point of view. One moment he's carrying on in the prison, normal duties, sorting out the prisoners, looking after everything. Suddenly he's whisked away from that setting, that situation. And let's face it, it'll be dark and dingy. Suddenly he's whisked out of that. The prison clothes are no good to stand before the ruler of the whole nation. So he's washed, he's shaved, he's changed, and he's brought into this palace situation. I mean, we've gone from one situation that we can't really think of and understand into another situation that we can't really think of and understand either. I mean, the wealth that must have been on display. And suddenly, he's plonked in the position of being the one whom everybody is looking to, including Pharaoh. Suddenly, being transformed from what we call the lowliest of the low to being someone, somewhere, where this guy has hit the big time, and he has really hit the big time. Suddenly he's been transferred from lowly prisoner who nobody's really bothered about to somebody who's second in charge of the nation that was the real big hitter in that area. It's not like it was a little backwater country. Egypt was a major power. And he's suddenly transferred from nothing to number two. That is some dramatic change. And as I say, suddenly, he's hit the big time. Success. He's arrived. And we can see, if we didn't know the story, how suddenly everything's coming together. Everything's working right. Everything's working according to God's plan. It's going well. He really has arrived. Surely, God is at work. Well, yes, he is. Surely, this is success. Well, yes, it is. But what are we looking for with regards success? And what is God looking for with regards success? What counts as success? How do we measure success? What's our perspective on success? Matthew 17, verses 1 to 5. The story is that Jesus has taken three disciples with him up onto the mountain, and that's where it picks up. It says, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as light. Just then there appeared before him Moses and Elijah. They were talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I can pull up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And while he was still speaking, a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, this is my son whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Now at this point, Jesus was well into his ministry and he's still pretty popular. Obviously that changed quite a bit with the opposition from the Pharisees, where he had to be a little bit more careful where he was going and what he was doing. But at this point, everything seemed to be going well. Everything seemed to be going successfully. He'd healed on many occasions, some quite spectacular. He'd cast out demons. He'd even raised the dead. He'd sent out his disciples and said, look, you do what I'm doing. You heal. You cast out demons. And you raise the dead. And they went out, they came back and said, wow, Lord, it's tremendous. It's exactly as you said. Everything's going well. This is success. He had been on the mountainside and with just a few bits and pieces, he'd fed 5,000 people. Not only that, he'd actually walked on water. Staggering. And God the Father says, this is my son, with him I am well pleased. Surely this is success. It's understandable for God to be pleased with him. Everything was going really well. But I also want to read to you from Matthew chapter 3. Verses 13 through to 17. This is what it says. Then Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John. But John tried to deter him, saying, I need to be baptized by you, and you come to me? Jesus replied, let it be so for now. It's proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness. And then John consented. As soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water. And at that moment, heaven was opened and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting upon him. And a voice from heaven said, this is my son whom I love. With him, I am well pleased. So he's saying at this point, exactly the same thing that he would say much further down the line. But at this point, Jesus had healed nobody. At this point, Jesus had not cast out a single demon. He'd definitely not raised the dead. He was still in the situation where he had no disciples. It would be after this that he started to gather the 12. So he'd certainly not sent them out anywhere. There wasn't this sort of blossoming of a ministry. He'd never walked on water, never done anything. In fact, he'd never even been at the wedding of Cana where the water was miraculously transformed into wine. But God the Father said exactly the same he would say further down the line. He said, "This is my Son with whom I am well pleased." In God's eyes, at that point, Jesus was pleasing. At that point, Jesus was successful. What he had done was not even written about, because in many ways, there was nothing to write about. So what had he done to please the Father? What had he done to sort of record any kind of success? Nothing outstanding. It's simply been obedient. But that was pleasing to God. And as far as God was concerned, that was successful. And he could give exactly the same judgment at that point as he would further down the line. Sometimes the things that we're doing, sometimes where we are, can seem small, insignificant, and even in a backwater. But what does God require? You know, you can compare, and I can't do it to any great extent because my ignorance is quite extensive in this area, a top flight footballer to a Sunday league footballer. One, playing matches where the thing's televised, where perhaps thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even millions, if it's something like a World Cup, can be glued, absolutely riveted by the performance. Paid thousands, tens of thousands, maybe even millions. Some of the transfer fees are astounding, the amounts they talk about. People know their name. Even I've heard of Ronaldo, Messi, and so on, because they become household names because they're so famous. You walk down the street and there's somebody wearing a shirt that's not got their name on it, it's got the footballer's name on it. They want to identify with this successful player. People would love to be in their position. They'd love to be as successful as they are. The Sunday league footballer, maybe half a dozen people watching at the sideline, if any, especially if it's raining, but they're still there. Nobody's wearing shirts with their name on it. They're probably wearing shirts with somebody else's name on it, hoping that maybe a little bit of their success will sort of rub off on them so that Ronaldo actually does score. But then you can't really compare the skill. You know, there was a thing that I watched on YouTube where Ronaldo got dressed up as a sort of a, well, almost like a tramp, and he went out into the middle of Madrid. And he started kicking a ball around, then he started displaying some skill and people were amazed, and then they revealed who he was. Wow, he's fantastic. That doesn't happen to Sunday league players. The way that they are regarded, the way that they are rewarded is completely different. Because we know which one's been successful. In Micah 6, verses 6 to 8, in the midst of everything that was going on, Micah writes these words. "With what shall I come before the Lord, and how Can I come before the exalted God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves the year old? Would the Lord would please with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of olive oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? And in response he says this, He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? To act justly, love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. To act justly and to love mercy. To live out a godly life. It's been said that these two things embrace the whole of the commandments. What's required of us? To live like this. Whoever we are and wherever we are. To walk humbly with God, follow in his ways, follow his footsteps, being in fellowship with him. In Matthew 23, verse 23, Jesus says this, Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, cumin, but you've neglected the more important matters of the law, which are justice and mercy and faithfulness. And it's the same wherever we are. It's the same whoever we are. In 1 Samuel 15, we read of a mission that King Saul had been sent on. He's confronted by Samuel. And Samuel says to him, You have not done as you were told. And Saul's response is this, I did obey the Lord. I went on the mission that the Lord assigned to me. I completely destroyed the Amalekites and brought back Agag, their king. So we've got an instant contradiction there. I've destroyed them all and I brought this guy back as well. But let's skip that for the moment. The soldiers took sheep and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was devoted to God. They'd been told to destroy everything, but we still sort of got some things while we were there. But we're going to give them to God. So that's all right then. But Samuel replied, Does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice. And that's whether it's a sacrifice that you've come across or whether you've gone to great lengths to make it. The Lord is more important. The Lord is more interested in obedience. Goes on to say that rebellion is like the sin of divination. Following God's way is required for each one of us. And that is success. In Matthew 25, Jesus gave him a parable. And he said this, The kingdom of heaven is like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his wealth to them. To one he gave 5 bags of gold, to another 2 bags, and to another 1 bag, each according to their ability. So he didn't give sort of a whole bag of somebody who couldn't cope with it. And he didn't give 5 bags to one who could handle 1 bag, or 3 bags to somebody who could only handle 1 bag, or 5 bags to somebody, etc. He gave it according to ability. And God gives responsibility according to ability. And he also gives the ability as well. So he knows what he's playing at. Whatever the situation we are in, we're called to follow him. Because the situation that we're in, if we're following him, is down to him. And the ability that we have, we're called to use that to follow him. Because again, the ability we have is solely down to God. In Luke 12:48 says, From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. The question being, what has God given us? The question also is, what are we looking for? And how are we measuring success in our own situations? The story is told of a cathedral refurbishment. It's very old, but the stonework had been exquisitely carved. It's tremendous. But over the years, it had got contaminated and discoloured, and in places, even bits had chipped away. So the decision was made to renovate. The scaffolding was erected because obviously they've got to get up there. And experts were called in to restore, to clean, to preserve. But while they were there, they came across something very interesting. In a part of the roof that could not be seen from below, they found exquisite carvings. But they couldn't be seen. It was only when they got the scaffolding there and were sort of working through it, they came across the carvings. Nobody knew they were even there. Some craftsmen had gone to a lot of trouble to create something that, as far as he was concerned, nobody else would ever see. Why did he do it? Because he was looking to please God. He was looking to fulfill his craftsmanship for an audience of one. So what does God trust us with? And how does God count success? How does he measure success? God looks for obedience in every situation, in any situation. In 1 Corinthians 4, verse 2, it says, "Now it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful." And it's the same for every single one of us. But what do we want? What are we aiming for? What's our measure of success? More importantly, what is God aiming for? And what is his measure of success? Because God is the same God in every situation, and he requires the same in every situation to be faithful. And it doesn't matter whether, say the concert, the Viennese concert, New Year's Day concert, the guy waving the baton, everybody can see him, it's televised around the world, or whether it's somebody holding a brush who nobody's looking at. And it doesn't matter whether it's somebody on the TV giving some erudite speech, passing on some wisdom, giving their opinion, or somebody talking to a toddler who once again just is not listening. What God requires is faithfulness. Whether it's seen or whether it's unseen. We're told not to despise days of small things that we regard as insignificant, hardly worth bothering with, because God requires faithfulness. We don't despise what we perhaps regard as unimportant, of, well, worth little consideration, because who's going to know anyway? We should not despise the small things, the inconsequential. And after all, who's to say it's inconsequential? How many memories have you got of parents who perhaps have done something for you and it's stuck with you? Good and bad. But it's lodged there in your mind, and how has that affected you? God wants you to be an agent for God. God wants me to be a person who makes the change, who shows God, who works with justice and mercy and is obedient. After all, who are we aiming to impress? The people who look up at the sculptures and think, wow, they were brilliant craftsmen, or the people who look up and never see the intricate crafts work that's being carried out, but God knows it's there. I doubt if ever we will be on the world stage. If it's coming for me, it's taking its time arriving, I can say that. But you never know, maybe tomorrow. We might never hit the big time. We might never hit what we call big time. But every day we can hit the big time for God because we love mercy, love justice, and we walk humbly with our God. Joseph was a success in Pharaoh's court, but Joseph was a success in the prison. Joseph was a success in Potiphar's household, but Joseph was also a success at the bottom of the well when he thought that was it. Remember, at the start of Jesus' ministry, his father said he was well pleased with him. And even when he'd done amazing things, it didn't get better. Didn't sort of get to the stage where God said, well, he was doing well then, but he's really doing well now. You know, now he's arrived, now he's doing what I really wanted him to do. You get the same thing at both ends. Well pleased. What is success? Success at the end of the day is to do the will of God. Wherever we are, whatever we do, whoever we are, whatever we do for an audience of one. And if somebody else sees it, that's fine. Don't worry about it. God measures success not by how many people we impress. He measures success not if we're on a world stage. He measures success by how faithful we're following him. If we don't hit the big time, fair enough. That's the way it will be. We may never perform for thousands, millions, but we might, and we are able to perform for the one person who controls everything. And he never misses a jot. We don't hit the big time by being famous. We hit the big time by hearing these words, well done, good and faithful servant. Amen.